Trade war status update. Oh, it's back on. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, the 6th day of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. They tell you when you're learning how to do business and economic journalism on the radio, not to throw too many numbers at people all at once. It's a rule we try to follow pretty strictly around here. Today being a notable, a rare, and a regrettable exception because the macroeconomic news of this Monday is brought to us by two numbers. 232, that's the relevant section of the Trade Expansion Act of 1962 that we are going to be talking about, and Section 301 of the Trade Act of 1974. Now, why start with numbers, Kai? Well, because President Trump, as you might be aware, is talking about putting more tariffs on more Chinese goods, and it occurred to us that this might be a good day for a where do things stand in the trade war update. Soumaya Keynes is the U.S. economics editor at The Economist. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So I gave the primer up there on 232 and 301 and what they are. And I guess the reason we got you on the phone is so you can explain the state of play. And let's take the 232 steel and aluminum tariffs first, if we could. Where do things stand with those?
Well, they're in place. We have tariffs on steel, tariffs on aluminium. In theory, some of them were supposed to come off, perhaps after the USMCA, the new agreement with Mexico and Canada, after that was agreed. But it doesn't look like there's a huge amount of progress in those discussions. As things stand, they're in effect, and there's fairly good evidence that American consumers are paying more for steel and aluminium as a result.
Yeah, there have been some academic studies showing exactly that. And these are in effect now on Canadians, on the European Union, on Mexico, traditionally our allies in global trade, right?
Indeed. And that's what makes them so strange, because these Section 232 tariffs are supposed to be in the name of national security.
Right.
It does seem odd that America has decided that imports from its allies are a threat to its national security, in effect.
Okay. So to the ones that the president has been tweeting about the past day and a half or whatever, they're called Section 301, and they are all about unfair trade practices. And there have been several tranches of these, several slices.
Indeed. So much fun for us trade nerds. But roughly, you can put them into two buckets. Mm-hmm. So the first bucket, the tariff is around 25%. And in theory, they're on these special high-tech goods the U.S. is targeting, because China has these plans to specialize in these high-tech goods, and the U.S. doesn't like that. The second bucket is on around $200 billion worth of imports from China. There, the tariffs are lower. They're 10%. And it's this bucket that the president has just threatened to increase the tariff, so to raise that tariff from 10% to 25%.
And he's also talking, so this is about half of what we import from the Chinese. He's also talking about tariffing another $300 billion worth of stuff. In other words, almost everything that we import.
Pretty much, yeah. And I think, you know, that sounds alarming, and it is. It's a lot of stuff. One thing to say is that it's unlikely that those tariffs could happen overnight, and therefore there's some chance that maybe they'll reach a deal before that actually goes into effect.
Very quick follow-on question, and then I'll let you go before we get too far down in the weeds on this stuff, and it goes like this. The president has been unpredictable, to be charitable, with his trade policy pronouncements. The market clearly, after an early morning freak out about this, has decided maybe it's not so bad. What do you believe, based on your reporting, the odds are that this actually happens on Friday?
Oh, yeah. That's a toughie. The thing I was really watching for today was whether the Chinese delegation was going to come on Wednesday.
Yeah.
It now looks like they are going to come. In which case there will be a round of negotiations, and it is, I think, still fairly likely that there is some agreement by the end of the week. That said, predicting what the president is going to do is a fool's errand, and so I could well be wrong.
Soumaya Keynes, she's the U.S. economics editor at The Economist. Thanks a lot. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Wall Street, as I alluded to, pretty much took the president's threats in stride, at least by the close. In China, there was no striding. The Shanghai Composite Index was off more than 5% today. The yuan, the Chinese currency, got clobbered. And as a result, as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports of all of this Chinese tariff stuff, Chinese leaders find themselves in a tough position.
In China, the terror threat from Washington came on the 100th anniversary of foreigners pushing China around. The 1919 Treaty of Versailles granted the Japanese control over a chunk of Chinese territory. Bad time for President Xi Jinping to look weak before a home crowd. Susan Shirk heads the 21st Century China Center at UC San Diego.
The trick for Xi Jinping is to make these bold structural changes without looking like he's just caving in. President Trump has made that very hard for him.
It's a delicate moment for China. The economy has slowed in recent years, and trade war made it worse. Today, central bankers in Beijing made it easier to borrow to offset the tariff threat. Analyst Peter Doni Sanu at the Wells Fargo Investment Institute says in this two-way trade war, tariffs hurt China more.
So that does naturally make China more exposed to anything that would reduce the amount of trade or exports than the U.S. economy.
Still, Chinese leaders have something going for them, a rising nationalism and anti-Trump sentiment, says Cheng Li at the Brookings Institution.
Chinese media in 2017 actually are quite positive about Donald Trump. But now the public opinion start to change. They now think President Donald Trump is greedy or even crazy.
A trending post in Chinese social media blends an image of Trump with Thanos, the Avengers movie supervillain. On a day when trade news was censored in Chinese official media, this was not. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Despite President Trump's persistent misrepresentations about this, these tariffs are being paid by American consumers. And yet, overall, inflation in this economy is pretty tame. So if, and granted it's still an if, the president bumps these tariffs as promised or expands them to virtually all Chinese imports, might we then see some inflation? We asked Marketplace's Justin Ho to look into that one.
Here's the good news. We just don't spend that much money on imports, says economist Sarah House at Wells Fargo.
At the end of the day, about two-thirds of consumer spending is on services, which we import very little of and are not subject to these tariffs.
Healthcare, for instance. If the Trump administration imposed a 25% tariff on all Chinese imports, the San Francisco Fed recently estimated that would increase inflation by 0.3%. Economics professor Tim Dewey at the University of Oregon says Americans will end up footing the bill.
We know that the impact of tariffs will fall on producers and consumers.
Consumers who'd pay more for imported refrigerators or certain types of furniture, and producers who've already been dealing with the impact of existing tariffs on Chinese imports, says Karen Cavanaugh at Voya Investment Management.
A lot of companies have looked for alternative supply chains. They've looked to diversify their source of suppliers.
A lot of producers might wind up eating the tariff hikes themselves. Sarah House at Wells Fargo says it might be a while before consumers notice higher prices at Walmart or Target.
Retailers might already have prices locked in for certain shipments that are coming up for the next few months.
House says the impact of a tariff hike would be short-lived, basically a one-time expense. She says tariffs would only start nudging inflation upward if the U.S. slaps more of them on Chinese goods as the dispute continues. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
This whole on-again, off-again trade war thing can be messy and complicated. We know that. And it makes the timeline that we put together making sense of it all pretty helpful. You can check it out at areweinatradewar.com. Wall Street this Monday, really, really terrible. Then down just a touch. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Lots going on the Uber front this week. Shares are expected to start trading on Friday. Drivers are expected to strike on Wednesday to draw attention to the company's labor practices. Elsewhere in the Uber economy, there is the challenge of ride-sharing becoming a stand-in for public transit. The company does have partnerships with a bunch of cities, but Innisfil, that's a suburb of Toronto, went all in on Uberizing public transportation. Laura Bliss wrote about it for CityLab. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tell me how this town in Canada, Innisfil by name, became sort of this testbed for Uber as a surrogate for mass transit.
Absolutely. So there is this increasingly popular idea, I would say, in cities all over North America that they're falling behind the times, right? We see transit ridership declining in big cities and small cities. We see people complaining about the infrastructure falling apart. And for all kinds of reasons, cities are looking at these new services or newish at this point, Uber and Lyft, and thinking maybe they can help us, right? Maybe they can kind of help us, one, look like we're kind of part of the 20th century and part of this new wave of tech-enabled services. And also, maybe they can actually do a better job, right, of getting people from A to B at a price we can better afford.
So the town elders then in Innisfil said, what was the mechanism? How did they decide to do this?
Yeah, so this was back in 2015. The town has been growing pretty rapidly, and they've never had public transit really of any kind before. But they were looking at their population surging and thinking, okay, it's time. And as they were sort of doing the study of looking at what the cost would be of like a traditional fixed route bus or, you know, one or two lines, they did the math and figured that it would be a lot more cost effective to get everyone around in subsidized Ubers, right? So even if the city just paid a few bucks per ride, that would be cheaper than installing this bus. And so that's what they did in 2017. They rolled out Innisfil Transit, which was just Ubers.
And then in 2018, this thing basically explodes. I mean, it becomes a victim of its own success.
Right, yeah. I mean, it's super successful. They had like 80,000 rides by the end of their last full year in operation, like a 70% approval rating, which like every, you know, big city transit agency would be super envious of.
Right.
But this was costing the city a lot of money, right? Because unlike a traditional fixed route bus, where it actually gets cheaper per rider to pay for, the subsidy that the city was paying was growing pretty substantially year over year. And so this year, as of April 1st, the city had to raise fares by $1. And more worryingly, actually, to the people who have started to rely on it super regularly for getting to work and school, is that the city implemented a 30-trip-per-month cap.
So what is the mass transit using public in Innisfil? And in theory, other towns around the world that will try some version of this, what are they supposed to do?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we're seeing Boston, we're seeing big counties in Florida, we're seeing suburbs outside of Denver all looking to Uber and Lyft and other ride-hailing services as some kind of supplement, you know, or a substitute to public transit. And I think that the Innisfil story is that ride-hailing is never going to be a panacea for public transit services, and it's never going to replace what a well-designed transit system is going to do. And so I think, you know, the experts I spoke to kind of said, like, you know, I think as long as cities are sort of narrowly defining their goals and what they're hoping to get out of this kind of partnership, then okay, but it's not going to be kind of a silver bullet solution.
Laura Bliss, West Coast Bureau Chief at CityLab. That's part of The Atlantic. A piece about Canada, actually, and Uber and public transit. Laura, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for having me. This was really fun.
Should you be in New York City and without plans this evening, there's a thing at the Metropolitan Museum of Art you might want to check out. I mean, you'll never get in, but you could probably kill a couple of minutes watching the rich and famous walk by. The Met Gala, the annual fundraiser for the museum's Costume Institute, is tonight, hosted and meticulously curated by Vogue editor-in-chief Anna Wintour, the place for designers and celebrities to both see and be seen in elaborate getups. At a price. Designers and companies spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to buy tables and to dress those celebrities at the gala. But that calculation is changing in this social media age, as Marketplace's Mariel Segarra reports.
There's this scene in Ocean's 8, the heist movie. A designer, played by Helena Bonham Carter, is trying to convince a jeweler at Cartier to let the celebrity she's dressing borrow a $150 million necklace for the Met Gala.
I have always loved Cartier. I think, historically, this has been the most significant house in the world. But there is a whole generation out there who mispronounce your name. Je sais, vous êtes monsieur.
This necklace isn't doing you any good sitting in a vault, she says in French, when it could be going viral around the world.
This is an exercise in branding.
Bronwyn Cosgrave, a fashion historian at Parsons School of Design, says the Met Gala allows designers to capture the world's attention. Rihanna shows up dressed as the Pope in a sparkly white robe designed by John Galliano, and it goes viral.
You might not want to wear that huge headdress that Rihanna or Sarah Jessica Parker is wearing, but you might be interested in the brand.
And in its less expensive products, Sean Grain Carter teaches at the Fashion Institute of Technology.
You go and buy the perfume. You go and buy the shoes, the handbag.
The gala can be expensive for designers. They have to create these elaborate outfits, and tables can cost up to $300,000. It can be cheaper and more cost-effective to reach potential customers directly on their Instagram feeds. Brands can pay celebrities to wear their clothes and post about it. Bronwyn Cosgrave again.
Today, influencers really do rival the runway.
And that may be why, as Women's Wear Daily reported, Ralph Lauren, Dior, and Calvin Klein have taken a step back from this year's Met Gala, deciding not to buy entire tables. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
Coming up.
We're just at the point where we're debating how much resources do we really want to devote.
How one business owner is grappling with tariffs still. But first, let's do the numbers. Down more than 450 in early trading, as I mentioned. The Dow Industrials closed with a drop of just 66 points, 0.2%, 26,438. The NASDAQ dipped 40 points, about 0.5%, 81.23. The S&P 500 shed 13 points, 0.4%. 29 and 32. Most rattled by the tariff turbulence. Yeah, you try saying that 10 times fast. Companies relying on good relations with China. Apple shares slipped 1.5%. Nike down 2.5%. Industrials felt it as well. Shares of Caterpillar dropped 1.6%. John Deere shares plunged 4%. As Marielle was just telling us, tonight is the Super Bowl of fashion, the Met Gala, but fashion trading today did not look so good. The luxury conglomerate LVMH, parent of Louis Vuitton and Dior, down 3%. Today, Ralph Lauren, down 2.3%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, I'm Molly Wood. On the Marketplace Tech Podcast, we give you a daily smart take on the digital economy, from cybersecurity around local elections to how your television might give you personalized ads. We help you better understand the tech that impacts your life and your work. Join me every weekday for Marketplace Tech. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Here is today's seemingly random government economic statistic from which we can actually get a decent amount of big picture insight. According to the Census Bureau, the number of people working from home in this economy has more than doubled since 2005. And to be clear, that's for people who are not self-employed. Some companies are taking that trend to the limit, doing away altogether with actual physical workspaces. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino looked into the pluses and minuses.
Every week, Emily Bruninger gets paired up with a random colleague for a kind of office video chat roulette. This time, it's her teammate, Carlin Sack.
Yeah, where are you now? Are you back in Seattle or?
Not yet. Coming up, though, I'll be back in Seattle.
Even though it's mandated by her company, it's not a business meeting.
It's just 30 minutes to just talk about anything. So where do you live? Where are you from? What's your family like?
It's the kind of casual chit-chat you would normally hear around the office water cooler. But Bruninger and her colleague don't share a water cooler or an office because they work for Zapier, an app developer with about 200 employees, all of whom work remotely. CEO Wade Foster says despite the physical separation, it all comes together.
We have sort of shared set of goals and initiatives, and everyone sort of contributes their piece of the pie, and it all sort of works out.
The company has been all remote since Foster co-founded it 8 years ago, for good reason. No overhead costs, the ability to recruit from anywhere, satisfied employees, and therefore better retention. Arrangements like Zapier's are becoming more common. The Census Bureau says about 8 million Americans now primarily work from home, and more than half of them work for companies, not themselves.
When I started, remote work was very much viewed as fringe. It's evolved dramatically.
Sarah Suttenfell is the founder of FlexJobs, a search site for remote and flexible work. She said listings on the site have been springing up beyond the tech industry.
We have seen a growth in the depth and breadth of job types, the categories, the roles.
There are virtual law firms, virtual medical services.
We've seen virtual golf instructor jobs.
Xerox, American Express, Dell, and about 24 other Fortune 500 companies have made entire divisions remote. But it's not as simple as just giving employees a laptop and sending them home, says Judith Olson, a professor of computer science at UC Irvine, because moving people out of the office can make simple collaborative tasks way less efficient.
When you move to being distributed, then you're basically blind and you're invisible.
That means you have to go to greater lengths to communicate, and that can breed distrust, even in instances that would seem totally benign with someone you see every day.
If you're distant and you do something weird, like you don't respond to my email, what's called attribution error. I'm going to think that you are being bad.
That's why it's so important for companies to foster relationships among remote workers, says April Rinn, a business advisor on the future of work. The best remote companies, she says, find creative ways to simulate the benefits of office culture with things like Zapier's chat roulette or video conference birthday parties and trivia nights.
I guess I could call it engineered serendipity. That's a sort of oxymoron.
Still, solo workers can feel isolated.
What you find a lot that people need, it's not that they have to be connected to their colleagues, but they want to be connected to humans, to professionals, to a community.
Emily Bruninger at Zapier certainly does. In the beginning, she was pretty worried about the whole remote thing.
I'm a big extrovert. I was kind of nervous about feeling disconnected from my coworkers.
But she's finding a way to make it work. She spends much of her time in co-working spaces, but not in the United States. For the last 6 months, she's been traveling full-time with friends, hiking and surfing her way through Central America between meetings and emails.
And then I took my lunch break at the pool.
Not a bad replacement for the office water cooler. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
We started the program today on tariffs. We are going to end the program today on tariffs, specifically what it's like trying to run a business in a tariff economy. Todd Adams is one of the people doing that who we talk to from time to time, so we called him up the other day.
My name's Todd Adams, president of Sanitube, and we are a manufacturer of stainless steel tube valves and fittings for the food industry, and we are headquartered in Lakeland, Florida. We were told that there was a process for an exemption, which we did apply for, and unfortunately, our exemption request was denied based on technicalities related to the tariff code. We've since reapplied. It was kicked back one time. We're still working on it, but you know, we're just at the point where we're debating how much resources do we really want to devote to, you know, this process that seems to be relatively meaningless. Our ongoing business has been strong. We pay the tariff, and we've passed it on to the customer, which it seems that, you know, we have not had any pushback on, probably based on the strength of the economy and the fact that the material is needed. We're thankful for that. I can't say that we've shifted any of our any more manufacturing back to the U.S. based on the tariff. There's certainly a very deep sense of uncertainty, not only in, you know, in our company, but throughout the industry. We've been a lot more conservative with how much we've imported at a time. We don't know if what tomorrow might bring. There could be an announcement, just like there was for the 25% Section 232 tariffs. We're also very conservative with the quotes that we are that we're doing for customers. So customers have much less time to make a decision, and they have less certainty in their budgeting. We would be happy with just a final resolution, whatever it may be. We just want to see an end to the uncertainty, an end to the volatility.
Todd Adams, the president of Sanitube out of Lakeland, Florida. This final note on the way out today, just a teensy bit of a Game of Thrones spoiler. So go ahead and turn the volume down for about 5 seconds if you so choose. I'll wait. Okay, here you go. HBO's response this afternoon to the Daenerys Starbucks cup gaffe. Quote, the latte that appeared in the episode was a mistake. Daenerys had ordered an herbal tea. Yeah. All right, we got to go. Wall Street today, terrible early. By the close, not so bad. Dow closed with a drop of 66 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ down 40 points, about 0.5%. S&P 500 down 13 points, 0.4%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Daniel Shin. Our special projects desk is Tommy Andres and Eliza Mills. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.